Hi, listener. Emily here. And before we jump into this month's episode, a few quick updates. First of all, we wanted to apologize for how late this episode is coming out. We had a few editing issues that took a little bit longer than normal, but we think it was worth the wait. This will also be our last formal episode for 2020. We look forward to bringing you guys more episodes with great content in 2021. We hope that you, your friends, and family all have a safe and happy holiday season. Take care and enjoy this month's episode.
Hello, listener. Welcome to the University of Maryland Extension presents the Garden Time Podcast, where we talk about getting down and dirty in your garden. We're your hosts. I'm Rachel.
I'm Michaela.
And I'm Emily.
In this month's episode, we're chatting about putting your garden to bed for the winter, caring for holiday plants, and native fruits and vegetables.
It's wintertime, or we're getting close to wintertime, and as plants are starting to end production and so forth, it's time to start thinking about putting your garden to bed.
It's the perfect time to give your evergreens a little haircut. Now is a great time to shape your boxwood or ilex, if it needs it, with a little trim. However, you don't want to do any heavy pruning, since new growth will not have a chance to harden off before winter. You can trim hollies and evergreens during the winter if their branches will be used for decorations, but severe pruning of evergreens should be done in the early spring.
So I actually like to recommend leaving native grasses and perennials up through the fall and into winter if you can help it. You can tidy up plants as they start to look ratty or miserable. But if you do have to cut things back, leave stems, or what we call stubble, at least 12 to 18 inches tall for overwintering pollinators and other insect activity. Cutting back should be delayed until late winter or very early spring before the new growth has a chance to get too tall. But if you do have ornamental grasses, you want to leave them standing as long as you can as well until they also look kind of ratty after a couple of northeasters. Even the prettiest ornamental grasses look kind of tired and miserable sometimes, so you can do a little trimming or maybe give them a little haircut. But don't leave all of that cutting until April or May, because that's getting to be too late. That's when that new growth is going to start to come up. And if you cut back then, you're going to cut back the early tender growth that those grasses are sending up. Your cleanup date for grasses can be as late as February or as early as December, depending on the severity of the weather. You can also leave these ornamental grasses and native grasses standing to create a lot of structure and fall and winter interest. And this also adds to a lot of color and interesting features, because things have seed pods and seed heads, and that also looks really attractive as well as very functional for all of the wildlife.
That's one of my favorite things about having the coneflowers in my garden, is that all the seeds give it that cool spiky look all throughout the fall and winter.
Michaela, what's your favorite native grass seed pod for the winter?
You know what? I love northern sea oats. They have really attractive seeds. And the seed heads actually make good cuttings, too. So if you're doing some kind of like winter or Christmas activity or arrangement, they make a really nice addition. But one thing I will say about cutting seed heads is, if you have a particularly aggressive grass, such as either the Chinese silverhair grass, or if you have a couple of native grasses that tend to self-seed, you definitely want to cut those seed heads back before winter, because otherwise they will continue to spread and you'll have other little seedlings coming up the following year. So that's the only time I would recommend taking those seed heads out.
Late autumn into winter is also a great time to add some compost to your garden beds after you've cut down all of those perennials. You can also do things like mulch your garden paths with straw and leaves and newspapers and let them sit on top of the beds over winter. And then by springtime, they'll easily crumble into the soil and can get worked in. You can also use things like grass clippings, particularly if they're from your yard and you know that no herbicide has been applied to them, or leaves from your yard and your neighbor's yards as well. You do need to remember that the Maryland fertilizer law says that no fertilizer can be applied to Maryland lawns between November 15th and March 1st. So now would be the ideal time to apply any of that stuff that needs to be done. It's also a great time to take that soil test.
You know we love soil testing.
Yes.
So fall is a great time for those pH amendments as well, because they take some time in order to incorporate into the soil. And the freezing and thawing and the temperature changes, all of the biological things that happen during the winter help incorporate those products into the soil so that you'll be more ready for spring when you're doing any planting or if you're doing any treatments and fertilizers and stuff. So that's why we recommend a fall soil test, because it gives you a little bit more time to apply those products and have them incorporate into the soil before the spring.
And to learn more about how to take a soil test and why soil tests are important, go back to our April 2020 Part 1 episode when we have Dr. Nicole Filarlani as a guest speaker. You can also go to the University of Maryland's Home and Garden Information Center and look under soil testing for a list of local soil testing laboratories that you can mail your samples to, as well as information there about taking a soil test.
I also like to disconnect all of my hoses, soaker hoses, regular hoses, and any type of water fixtures now as well, because we're getting ready for temperatures to start dropping and getting some frost and freezing overnight. So just disconnect those, drain them, store them in your garage or your shed. Check them for any holes before you store them, just to make sure that, you know, hey, I might need to get rid of this so I don't hook it back up next year and it's got a kink or a hole in it. It's also a good time to disconnect, drain, and store any ornamental garden fountains. Clean off any algae growth with a soft brush and water. I don't use soap or bleach for that, just to make sure that I don't have any residue for the next season. And large fountains that can't be moved can be covered if you drain them and make sure that they're dry. So you can just place some fabric in the fountain before covering it to make sure it absorbs any of the moisture.
This is also a really good time to winterize your rain barrels, which should be disconnected and drained of water before winter comes, because you don't want everything freezing inside of the rain barrel, because it can harm the integrity of both the rain barrel and of the little fixtures that allow it to drain and allow water to come in. So now's a good time to pay attention to those things as well. And so if you use a diverter, I would take it out. But if the spout, you know, is up high and there's no way to like drain the water, it just falls like on the sidewalk or on the bare soil or something, yeah, then you should probably leave a rain barrel there.
I think at that point, it would be a good reminder then that after any rain events, you do need to remember to go out and drain your rain barrel so that it doesn't have sitting water in it that would likely freeze and ruin the integrity of your rain barrel. Because even if the whole thing doesn't freeze solid, just some of it freezing could definitely weaken the barrel. Plants make ideal gifts to give to people during the holiday season. Before buying either a holiday plant for yourself or for others, make sure to check the plant for insects and diseases. So you always want to check them for insects such as mealybugs and spider mites in the store, as well as diseases as well. So you want to make sure that none of the leaves have any spots or discoloration on them. You do want to check to make sure that they have been watered properly. So you can do this by lifting the plant up and feeling how heavy it is. If it's super light, chances are it's been underwatered. And if it's really heavy, it might be sitting in too much water and the roots may have become root bound or rotted. Don't hesitate to actually take the plant out of the pot and look at it. You want to see nice bright white roots, not dark or brown colored ones. And you don't want the roots to be fully impacted or root bound on the plant itself.
So I know it was recommended to me when I bring in my citrus plant to, regardless of whatever you see, to spray it with some horticultural oil or soap. Do you think you would recommend the same thing for holiday plants that you're bringing in?
I think if you're buying them from like a reputable nursery that you normally haven't had troubles with, probably not. But if you're going to like a big box store and they're around some plants that look questionable, whether or not you want to use horticulture oil, or like I tend to take mine
And I will actually put it into my sink, and then I will wash it with, like, nice, like, lukewarm water, and I'll, like, wash off all the leaves and give it, like, a good soak. So.
Oh, okay.
I would also recommend when you bring them in, you want to keep them in a room away from other plants. So keep them in, like, a little quarantine area for at least a week to make sure.
So some other things to be careful of as you're bringing indoor is any cut flower or evergreen decor. This includes carefully examining boxwood wreaths and decorative greens for symptoms of boxwood blight before buying. Be aware that sometimes infected plants don't show symptoms but are disease carriers. But things that carry boxwood blight, what happens is the leaves go brown very quickly and they defoliate completely from the branches. And you will probably see black or dark lesions on the stems themselves. These are some common boxwood blight symptoms. Also be aware that if they are cuttings, those branches aren't going to live indefinitely, so they may start to turn brown and defoliate just in terms of that they were cut and that they're slowly dying. But those early symptoms, if it's a fresh wreath or fresh decorative greens, they shouldn't be exhibiting those symptoms immediately. You can also check out the Home and Garden Information webpage. They have an entire page on boxwood blight, and the address for that is extension.umd.edu/HGIC. So another thing that you can do, especially with these fresh greens kind of decor, is you want to make sure you're disposing of them in the trash and not disposing in your compost pile, because that's where disease gets spread accidentally, or if you aren't sure whether your greens have the symptoms of boxwood blight or not, it's just better safe than sorry. So you can either bag it and throw it in the trash or throw it in with your regular trash. Just make sure that you aren't sending it to the landfill where they keep the woody branches or the brush pile, and you don't want to throw them in your compost bin either.
I love poinsettias in the winter. For me, I love the variety of colors that they come in, from the pale pink to the coral to the deep red. I just think there's nothing better for me to add in my home decor when I'm getting ready for the holidays to throw in a couple of poinsettias, or to make sure that I have them available to give them away to people as gifts and that kind of thing. Poinsettias are native to Mexico. They're in the Euphorbia family, and they are one of the most popular holiday plants because of their colorful bracts, modified leaves. Poinsettias were introduced in the United States in 1828 by Joel Poinsett. He was a botanist and a physician and the first United States ambassador to Mexico. In their native range, poinsettias are a perennial shrub that will grow from 10 to 15 feet tall. Their flowers are actually made up of brackets, which look like petals and have tiny yellow flowers in the center called setia. The colorful bracts attract insects to the flowers and will drop after pollination. Poinsettias were believed to be poisonous. However, they really are not. It's just that some people that have a reaction to latex will also have a reaction to the oozy, milky sap of the poinsettia plant. And that reaction is mostly a skin reaction from touching the leaves or the sap. For pets, the poinsettia sap may cause a mild irritation and nausea. So it's probably best to keep pets away from the plant, especially puppies and kittens who like to chew. To keep poinsettias healthy, keep them away from dry, drafty locations. Don't place them near heat vents, doorways, or drafty windows. I always like to remove the decorative pot cover and make sure that they have holes on the bottom so they don't get overwatered. When you water your poinsettia, you feel the soil first, make sure it's a little dry, and then water. If you want to get your poinsettia to rebloom, check out Dr. Leonard Perry, Extension Professor Emeritus for the University of Vermont, and his guide to caring for your poinsettia year-round. He developed easy-to-follow steps and a poinsettia care calendar based on the holidays of the year.
So holiday cactuses are actually my favorite of the holiday flowers just because they are fairly easy to care for. And we actually have three different ones that you can find. One would be the Thanksgiving cactus, the other is the Christmas, and then the final one is the Easter. And they're sort of named based off of what time of year you tend to get them in bloom. They originated in the southeastern coastal area of Brazil in shady and humid forests. They are a tropical cactus and not a desert cactus. So they do like a more humid environment, as well as they do like a slightly more wetter environment. So their water needs are a lot higher than that of, say, you know, one of your desert succulent cactuses. They also tend to really like bright, intense light, so you'd want to keep them in a sunny spot, or if you want them to bloom in time for the winter holiday season, their flowers will respond with shorter daylight and nighttime temperatures. So now is about the time to start reducing the amount of light that they get, as well as trying to keep them slightly cooler in order to kind of get that plant to kick in to producing blooms. And you can do this by placing them in a room that doesn't have any artificial light so that they are getting light purely from a window. You should not be fertilizing them in order to get them to bloom. Fertilizer will actually cause them to put more energy into leaf production than into flower production. One common issue that people will encounter with these types of cactuses is that the plant will develop flower buds, but they will drop off before they bloom. This can be a sign that your plant is either receiving too much water, not enough water, or not enough light. So you may want to try checking to see if it needs water, if it's got too much water, or relocating it to an area that might have more or less light. These guys also tend to like being slightly more on the root-bound side, so if you do need to repot it, only go up about one size up, because if they have too much space, they spend a lot of time and energy putting in a root system rather than putting that energy into making flowers. After they bloom, you can go ahead and pinch back some of the branches, and this will cause them to have a more fuller, branchier look.
What I love about Christmas cactus is that they're very easy to propagate. And so that makes either a really fun activity if you have some older kids to work with, or if you plan to try and give them as gifts to people, they make very personalized gifts because they were things that you actually grow. And Christmas cactuses always remind me of my dad's family because all of the women in my dad's family have a Christmas cactus that came from the Christmas cactus another one had. So it's really like a personal thing that I think is kind of nice.
Now, Michaela, if I wanted to propagate off of my Christmas cactus, what would I need to do?
Well, it's pretty easy. You know, a lot of things require like rooting powder or something like that. These guys don't need that. In fact, from what I understand is you just use the flat stem cuttings that are a whole segment long. Make sure that you include the bottom of the section is called a node because that's where the roots will start to grow. Because if you just have the middle section of the leaf, it's not going to root very easily. In fact, it probably will just rot and die. So, and you also want to make sure you're using fresh potting media. And I actually recommend using the potting media that's approved for cactus because it tends to drain a little bit better. And especially with taking any cuttings or propagating any cuttings, is too much moisture can sometimes cause those specimens to rot, but that cactus potting media will drain a little bit easier. So that's what I recommend trying to use.
All right, amaryllis is a beautiful bulb plant that is native to South America. It produces large, colorful, bell-shaped flowers that thrives indoors during our winter season. Most people treat their amaryllis as a one-and-done flower, but if you do it right, you can get them to produce for several years. I have not yet perfected it, but I try every year. Each flower can last about 2 weeks, sometimes longer, depending on how you care for it, the lighting conditions, and the environment within your house. They grow to about 24 inches tall, and I usually have to stake mine when they get pretty tall, because if not, then they can flop over after a while. After planting the bulb, begin to water sparingly to keep the potting mixture barely moist. When you can see about 2 to 3 inches of growth, increase the watering to keep the soil moist but not wet. Flower stalks usually emerge first, but it's not unusual for the leaves to do so as well. Allow the top half inch of the soil to dry out in between waterings. When blooming, water them regularly to keep the potting mixture moist and water less after the flowers fade. It's not necessary to fertilize them at this point in time. You also want to make sure that when you're planting those amaryllis bulbs, you don't necessarily have to cover the entire bulb with soil. You can leave a good half inch to an inch uncovered. And I usually like to use just plain coconut fiber as my potting mixture for amaryllis. Sometimes when you get those packets, they already come with the little pressed disc of coconut fiber. And that helps them dry down in between waterings. It doesn't really hold moisture the same way that regular potting soil does. So after planting the bulb, you want to make sure that you place it in a sunny window. They need bright light during their active growth period. You can rotate the plant slightly so that each side of the plant gets the right amount of light so it doesn't start to get spindly or floppy. The Home and Garden Information Center has a really great page on amaryllis care that you can look up. The different types of bulbs, lighting, water requirements, everything.
I actually am one of those people that's notoriously bad about going and buying the amaryllis kits where they've already started to like go in the stores because then they mark them half price. So I always have tons of these bulbs in like January blooming because they are too late for Christmas and people don't want them. But I love having them as like a fun pop of color in like January.
I think they make great winter gifts, period, not just Christmas gifts.
Oh, for sure.
Yeah, I do too. I love them.
If there's one thing I think that we all think about this time of year as harvest is coming to an end and we're getting ready to celebrate the holiday season, it's yummy food. So we are going to talk about some lesser known native fruits and vegetables. As our resident native plant expert, Michaela, do you want to start us off?
So I've got a great one to start with our native fruits, mostly because they're just kind of coming out of season, or, you know, the winter, late fall is a really good time for finding these, is our native persimmon. And this is Diospyros americana. And there are a lot of Asian or non-native varieties available that are usually cultivated for consumption or eating. But we also have this native species, and it's a deciduous tree native to Maryland, and it bears fruits very late in the season. Compared to the commercial varieties, this native fruit is a little bit smaller, and it has what's called an astringent skin. And all that means is it has a really tart or sharp flavor when you bite into it. And those skins develop either as a defense mechanism against pests, or that it's just the way that they've been developed. So after a couple of frosts, that tart, astringent skin breaks down, and it can usually be consumed by wildlife or humans, that includes us, either in the wild or if you grow them to harvest them. They can withstand a couple of those frosts and still taste pretty good. However, they can be harvested before a frost and prepared like a commercial Asian variety. It is very similar in texture. It's kind of a fleshy texture like a plum, but it's going to be less sweet than that. And it has a very beautiful color. It's like a dark orange that almost looks like an orangey tomato or something.
They're really pretty.
They're very pretty. And actually, there's a lot of Asian varieties that have varying colors of like red to really bright orange. And those are very attractive as well. So this is a tree that can reach heights of 75 feet tall. So it's definitely not recommended for small spaces, definitely more recommended for larger properties or forested areas. But this is a tree that is dioecious. And that term, to give you a throwback to Botany 101, means that you have male and female flowers on different plants. So you need a male and a female in order to produce the fruits we know and love. But just as a reminder, only the females bear fruit. So if you're going to plant like a crop of them, or if you're going to do an orchard of persimmons, you only need one male tree for several female trees. And I would say that there's probably quite a few locations in Maryland that you can find persimmons at the farmer's market. They're pretty readily available. They're not hard to find. But we also have some other native fruits, such as pawpaw, which is Asimina triloba. And this is actually the largest fruit produced in North America, I believe. This is a native fruit, and this comes from a tree that's actually not very large in comparison with like persimmon. Persimmon trees look like a legitimate deciduous tree. It has a very strong trunk and, you know, branches. But the pawpaw tree is actually more of like a colony of smaller trees. And it's an understory tree, meaning it prefers to be in the shade, or it doesn't like to be exposed to full sun. Although sometimes it's cultivated that way, that people will grow them as specimens in full sun. But in the wilds, they form these dense colonies. So in natural habitats, you'll find these in part to full shade. And it is a very interesting looking fruit, very easy to spot because it is so large, but it's kind of like a bean shape with very light green skin. And sometimes they'll develop in pairs. So you'll find two right next to each other on the branch, but they do have a very, very short harvest window. And we've already passed it, unfortunately, but maybe, you know, next year you'll have a chance to collect these. It's best collected in September. And once these fruits hit the ground, they spoil fairly quickly. So you'll notice the skin gets bruised really easy and it turns black. Just because it has a little black on it or a little bruising doesn't mean it's bad, but usually you can smell right away when the fruit is spoiled. So it needs to be either eaten, which it can be eaten raw. It doesn't need to be prepared, where you scoop it out with like a spoon. Or you can freeze it before it goes bad. So it's kind of like a frozen pulp, and it tastes really good mixed in smoothies. And even if you just eat it like the frozen pulp, it's almost like a custard. So the flavor is very tropical. It's kind of this hybrid of like a banana and pineapple flavor. I don't know if you guys have tried it. However, they do have very large brown seeds. They're very easy to spot, but you don't want to accidentally swallow them, because I think you could probably choke on it because they're very large. But like I said, due to that really short shelf life, you might most commonly find it as juice or sold as frozen pulp or even a sorbet, which would be very delicious. But it's definitely well worth trying it. In fact, if you can grow it, if you have the correct growing conditions, this is a great plant to have in the home landscape.
I think you need male and a female on those as well.
I don't know about that. I know that you need two different genetically different specimens to cross-pollinate. So they do need cross-pollination, but I don't think they're dioecious.
Okay, maybe I'm getting that confused. I knew that you needed at least two of them, and assumed that meant that they were dioecious, but maybe that's not the case.
So sometimes in nature, you'll find colonies of them, or a colony, and you may not see any fruits, and that's because that colony is all genetically the same, because they're all suckers. So that's why it is beneficial, especially if you're going to purchase them, to get two genetically different specimens, and then you'll have a better chance of fruiting. So that's kind of an interesting, and the flowers are really cool as well. I know we're talking about fruit, but the flowers are a very dark maroon color, and they're very primitive in that the flower smell is stinky. Like it smells like rotting something.
They're pollinated by flies.
Exactly. Exactly. I knew Emily would know. I was like, I'll throw that to Emily. But they're pollinated by flies. And that's what really primitive plants do, because flies were one of the first pollinators to develop. So
one of our other great native fruits is the serviceberry. Its scientific name is what, Michaela?
Amelanchier canadensis.
Awesome. These are being described as really similar to blueberries, and that makes them great because then you can use them for baking in things like pies and pastries, or I've actually gotten serviceberry jam before, and it is good as well. So these are a really fun, easy native fruit to sort of incorporate into your baking and other things. They are also really amazing plants to have in the landscape, even if you don't plan on harvesting the fruit, because at least 40 species of birds enjoy eating the fruit. Which, of course, is good because we're helping the environment, but bad if you actually wanted to harvest these to make pies and stuff out of, because you're probably going to need to put bird nets over them to keep them off of your delicious, delicious serviceberries. We have two different native species in Maryland, one that is found in the mountain region and one that is more common across the state. They tend to like to grow in shady understories areas, so this would be one that you would not necessarily want to put in full sun on your property. They tend to fruit early in the springtime, and they are an alternative host for apple cedar rust, though. So you do want to make sure that if you are putting them any place near a cedar or an apple tree, that you keep an eye out for them, as well as you may need to apply some organic fungicides or something like that to help control the fungus and to make sure that you get harvestable fruit.
What's great about these is some of our native fruits do have that astringent skin, like I talked about on the persimmon, but surface berry is not one of them. They're one of the few, like, they taste really good just raw, and so that's kind of nice that it doesn't have to be prepared. So it's really a cool plant. It's also one of the earliest spring blooming plants or shrubs that you'll see. And sometimes you might miss it because it has white flowers that could be mistaken for calorie pear. But it doesn't have the clusters of white flowers like calorie pear does. It's not as dense. They have petals that are much longer, more like oblong, and they're white. But I definitely would try and identify it in the spring. That's probably the easiest because at other times of the year, it's a very difficult plant to ID because its leaf shape is just like simple and it doesn't have any colors or other distinguishing features. It's not like the bark sheds or anything like that. So unless you can see the fruits or the flowers, it's really hard to identify.
Is this also the one that's known as Juneberry, or am I getting that confused with something?
Serviceberry, okay. Juneberry. Yep. Those are two of the common names, but Amelanchier is the genus name. And that's what we try to refer to it as just because there are lots of things across the United States, like Saskatoon berry, which it's a Western species. They also refer to these as shadbush. And I think that's a common name around the Eastern Shore because it also coincides with the time of year that the shad are running, the fish.
Oh, okay. I was like,
sorry.
Shad?
So, but I'm not a fisherwoman, so I don't know much about that, but I wondered where that name came from and somebody told me because it's the same time that the shad are active. So there's actually a children's book called When the Shadbush Blooms, and it's about a Native American girl who fishes for shad and recalls a time when her great-grandmother did as well.
Cool. Well, again, this is a fun one, and you can do all kinds of great baking with them. But again, the berries are probably available, what, spring or summer?
The berries? Summer, yeah. Definitely.
Summer, okay. So yeah, you'd be past the season to do anything now, but if you happen to have one of these, you could always make jam and can it next year to have alongside like your cranberries or something at Thanksgiving.
So another great addition is Jerusalem artichoke. And I'm going to try to say this correctly. So Michaela, if I don't do it properly, you got to correct me. Helianthus tuberosa.
Yeah, that sounds right.
Okay, well, verdict is in. So Jerusalem artichoke is not a artichoke, and it has no connection to Jerusalem at all. They're commonly available under the name of sunchoke or landchoke, and they have the taste similar to a water chestnut. I love water chestnuts, but I think it's going to be hard for you to find a food that I don't like besides tomato. So they are native to the eastern United States, and some historians think they might have originated in Ohio and the Mississippi River Valley. Native Americans grew them along with corn and beans. The tubers can be prepared in ways similar to potatoes. In addition, they can be made into flour or even pickled. Michigan State actually has a really good recipe for oven caramelized Jerusalem artichokes.
Oh, that sounds good.
I know.
I know people who consider this plant to be like invasive, or they don't desire this plant because it does have a tendency to spread. But harvesting it is a great reason to pull it up and to curb the numbers. But it does look similar to some other native plants around here, but they would not have that large tuberous root like the Jerusalem artichoke.
It's the Native Plants of the Month with Michaela.
No, I picked a grass again for my native plant of the month. This is actually, it's called Big Blue Stem, and it's Anthropogon gerardii. And it's actually not native to the coastal plain. It's more of a western part of Maryland, and it's this native grass is probably the most widespread across the United States. And it characterizes the tall grass prairies of the Midwest where they're very frequent. There's a lot of the prairie is dominated by this species. At one time, it was the most abundant native grass, and it was a very popular forage grass for livestock. It's incredibly tall, reaching about 7 to 9 feet in height, making it somewhat difficult to work as a specimen in a small home garden. But there's a lot of benefits to this grass, as there are to every native grass. You'll be rewarded with the russet tones and turkey foot seed heads. And what I mean by that is it looks like a turkey's foot. It's got like a, it's called approximate digitate, where the seed head is arranged in seed racemes of three, and they all connect at one point. And so this plant provides essential habitat for grassland birds, as well as hosting the Delaware and Dusted Skipper. So do you have trouble with browsing deer? Well, guess what? They don't like this. It's great to use as part of a meadow mix or to try something new. Even though it's not native to the Eastern Shore of Maryland, you can bet this is going to be the next addition to my grass specimen garden. It also has a high tolerance for a variety of growing conditions. And really the only thing it won't tolerate is full shade, which is pretty characteristic of many grasses. But this is definitely a really cool plant to see, especially working in kind of conservation restoration areas. There's a lot of companies that use this in their seed mix because it just has so many benefits for wildlife.
What's buzzing? It's the bug of the month with Emily.
This month's bug of the month is crane flies. So these are a type of true fly, which means that they only have one pair of wings, and a second pair of wings have been modified into what we call a halter. These are also known as mosquito hawks or flying daddy long legs. So these are those flies that have the very thin, narrow body and the very long, slender wings, as well as like very long, stilt-like legs. And you'll oftentimes find these up in like the corners in your porch, or even sometimes they'll manage to get in your house and you'll see them fluttering around like up in your corners, particularly in the fall and winter and in the springtime. They are actually really neat because they can date these back to the early Cretaceous period, so 145 to 100 million years ago. And they are found worldwide, with most of them being found in the tropics, but you do have some species that can be found in those higher northern latitudes and even in higher elevations up at, such as at the top of mountain peaks. So lots of really neat diversity in here. People oftentimes confuse them to be male mosquitoes, but in fact, they are not. Mosquitoes are a completely different family within Diptera, which is the true fly. So these guys are not mosquitoes. They are completely harmless, and actually the adults will feed on nectar if they feed at all. Some species will pupate and become adults, and they'll only live a few days. And in that point, they're mainly focusing on mating, so they don't feed at all. There's a fair amount of diversity with regards to the larvae stage. Some of them can be found underground in really damp environments, and others are fully aquatic, found in freshwater springs and ponds. They do tend to feed as larvae on decaying organic matter when they are in those aquatic environments. They are going to be a gray-browny kind of cylinder larvae that will have some fleshy lobes on the posterior ends. There have been a few species of larvae, particularly in Europe, that have been known to be pests on turf grass and in field crops. But here in the Mid-Atlantic, most of ours are aquatic and are not considered pests at all. You do tend to encounter the larvae in areas such as decomposing leaf litter and along ditch banks in December and January. And the adults will oftentimes emerge on warm days in early spring, so February throughout March. They, again, are completely harmless to pets and people. They don't sting, they don't bite. So for the most part, these guys are just a really cool kind of insect that you can find around. Some of them are actually really pretty. So a lot of them are very plain in coloration, but things like the banded wing crane fly has some really beautiful patterns on its wings. And there's a family amongst the flies called the phantom crane flies that are black and white and kind of striped pattern. And they're one of those things that you'll see them fluttering around, because these guys are not great flyers. So you'll literally see them like flying, and then it looks like they fall and then they kind of flutter. And you'll catch it out of the corner of your eye, and then you'll go to look for it, and it'll basically disappear because of that color patternation. But again, really kind of cool, neat insects. So yeah, that's my bug of the month.
I love that, Emily. That was way cool. We get them in our house all the time, And now I have more sympathy for them.
Uh-huh. Well, they're just kind of like, they're not really great flyers either.
Yeah, so they're kind of bumbling, like,
yeah.
Looking for a
so
mate.
So they get stuck in your corners. You're just kind of like, oh, you sad insect. You're like, you can't even get out of a corner. But they're really kind of cool, and the adults don't necessarily have a major environmental thing, although they are good food for things like bats. But the larvae, they're really good at, like, breaking down, like, leaf litter and stuff like that in, like, your streams and creeks. So.
Get your tip of the month here with Rachel. It is time for you to look out for spotted lanternfly egg masses. If you see any egg masses, you need to report them to your Department of Agriculture. So what do these egg masses look like? They're about 1 inch long, and they are laid on hard surfaces. So that could be trees, stones, patio furniture, grills, swing sets, you name it, that's where they're going to lay their eggs. The masses are covered with a white putty-like substance, and that ages over time to kind of look like cracked mud. If you see that on anything, you need to call your Department of Agriculture and report it. Take a picture, send it to your extension agent, make sure they know as well. And then you want to scrape that off and get rid of it. Penn State Extension has some really good pictures of egg masses, and we have some good ones on our Home and Garden Information Center website as well. Before our first hard freeze, you want to make sure that you mulch your perennials. This helps protect them from frost heaving. That's the freezing and thawing of soil. And mulch helps moderate the temperature fluctuations, reducing this problem. It's also a good time to amend your soil. If you took a soil test in October, dig organic matter into your garden beds, composted manure. You could use mushroom soil. Composted leaves or vegetable matter will help improve that soil structure. According to the Maryland Law Fertilizer Law, you cannot apply fertilizer to Maryland lawns between November 15th and March 1st. It's too late to broadcast lawn seed and expect it to survive the winter, so consider waiting until early spring to do this. You can add a thick blanket of shredded leaves to prevent erosion and nutrient runoff to your vegetable garden beds. It's also a good time to protect those late season crops like beets, spinach, broccoli rabe, Brussels sprouts, cabbage, cauliflower with some floating row cover, or you can do a sheet plastic over hoops. Make sure that you rake up and compost any fallen leaves. And it's also a really good time to clean and sharpen and stool your tools. And that's all I have for the garden tips of the month. Well, that's all we have for this episode, listener. We hope that you enjoyed it, and we'll tune in next month for more gardening tips. If you have any garden-related questions, please email us at umegardenpodcast@gmail.com or look us up on Facebook at Garden Time Podcast. That's Garden THYME.
For more information about the University of Maryland Extension and these topics, please check out the University of Maryland Extension Home and Garden Information Center website at extension.umd.edu/HGIC. Thanks for listening, and have fun getting down and dirty in your garden.
Goodbye! The Garden Time Podcast is brought to you by the University of Maryland Extension. Michaela Boley, Senior Agent for Horticulture in Talbot County, Rachel Rhodes, Agent Associate for Horticulture in Queen Anne's County, and Emily Zobel, Senior Agent Associate for Agriculture in Dorchester County.
University programs, activities, and facilities are available to all without regard to race, color, sex, gender identity or expression, sexual orientation, marital status, age, national origin, political affiliation, physical or mental disability, religion, protected veteran status, genetic information, personal appearance, or any other legally protected class.